Morning, you may be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. The next case on our calendar today is the matter of, or is A18-1271, Fletcher Properties, Inc. et al. Versus City of Minneapolis. Counsel for appellant will have 15 minutes for argument, followed by 15 minutes of argument for respondent, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel can please identify themselves when you as you start your argument and the party you represent. And if you need to adjust the podium, please feel free to do so. There's a switch on the podium. So you can proceed whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Kristen Sarf. I'm with the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office, and I represent the appellant City of Minneapolis. The district court erred as a matter of law by imposing a hierarchy amongst the city's plausible purposes for adopting a civil rights amendment, and then deliberately deciding to forego a rational basis review of the city's stated primary purpose for the amendment, increasing housing opportunities for low-income individuals that require housing choice vouchers to obtain housing. On this de novo review, this court is bound to conduct that very same rational basis review. The court must uphold the amendment on any set of facts, whether or not the facts are set forth in the text of the amendment, whether or not it's set forth in the public hearing, or the nearly 2 years' worth of community engagement and input gathering that the city conducted.
Didn't the court apply the rational basis test?
It did apply a rational basis test, but only to its own assessment of what the stated of the purpose of the amendment. The district court concluded that a rational basis review was appropriate because there wasn't a fundamental right implicated. But then he stated, even though the city, quote, repeatedly stated at the hearing, end quote, that the purpose of the amendment was to increase housing opportunities for voucher holders, that the more specific goal was to do so by declaring that the denials were prejudice-based discrimination.
Can we talk about the standard of review for a minute? It's your view that the district court properly applied the rational basis test. Respondent argues that strict scrutiny should apply because participation in the Section 8 voucher program can make it difficult to sell property, the rental properties, which would thereby interfere with a fundamental right. So why wouldn't strict scrutiny apply in this instance?
Because the plaintiffs haven't cited a single case in this jurisdiction or anywhere else the right to use, sell, or dispose of rental property, or any property for that matter, is a fundamental right. Instead, what they do is they cite to a series of cases talking about bundle of rights, but none of them implicate rental licenses. In contrast, the city cited to three out-of-state jurisdictions underneath the Longacre case in Washington, the Hills Development in Kentucky, and the McSwain case in Pennsylvania that all ruled that the right to sell or use property is not a fundamental right. Two of those, the Longacre case and the Hills Development case specifically related to rental rights. Back home here, there's more precedent for why the rational basis review would apply rather than the strict scrutiny applicable to fundamental rights. Back in 1979, the Minnesota Supreme Court applied the rational basis test to the Mineral Registration Act, which established forfeiture notice requirements for people who claim to have subsurface mineral rights. And if they didn't follow through on the notice requirements, their rights could be forfeited. So outright forfeiture of mineral rights. The Minnesota Supreme Court applied the rational basis test there. In 1996, this court applied the rational basis test to a city ordinance that said that for mobile park owners that choose to sell their property have a contingency that they have to help compensate the park residents that have to move. So that was a contingency associated with the right to sell their property. This court applied the rational basis test. Then
would
in 2014...
Would an unlawful taking... I know that the judge didn't address that here, but if it's an unlawful taking of property, would that also require the a rational basis test?
Yes, Your Honor. Candidly, because the regulatory taking wasn't one of the two counts that the court ruled on, I haven't brushed up on that case law, but yes, we had cases cited in the underlying summary judgment briefing that even a taking applies the rational basis test, particularly when an economic regulation is in place.
All right, is it your position, and I guess I just want to ask a general question about how this should be handled by the district court. I mean, the district court picked two grounds and ruled on and used the rational basis test. If there are other grounds that may require the strict scrutiny test, does that change the analysis here? Can the court pick and choose which ground the court wants to consider?
I hope I'm answering your question. So there's only two claims before the court, the equal protection and the substantive due process. And so if you determine that strict scrutiny applied on either one of them, then, actually, even under the equal protection, you just strike the offending portion, so it wouldn't resolve. I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is the court only took two of the five grounds that were presented.
Yes.
And applied the rational basis test as to those grounds. But if there is an unlawful taking, would that change the equation? And I think you said no when you've cited a case, you say. At least in your district court brief?
Yes, in the summary judgment briefing, we cited to multiple cases saying that when there's a regulatory taking claim made in the context of economic regulations that a rational basis test applies. I understand that you're just inquiring, but I do hope that you don't look to the other counts to establish an unlawful basis, because technically, since the court didn't rule on either any of those counts, you don't know if you would be reversing or affirming.
Correct.
Because he didn't rule.
Well, and I'm getting to the argument made by the respondent that the court declared those moot, and as far as they're concerned, they're not moot. They're still in play. And so I think I think they made that very clear and are objecting to the court's designation of those claims as moot.
I agree, except for when they say it's moot, what they're saying is it still needs to go back to the district court for determination rather than the decision should be made here.
Right.
Because obviously they concede that no ruling has been made on any of those other counts and that they believe they're entitled to other remedies, which of course our position is they never requested damages in a facial challenge. But
counsel, getting back to the rational basis test then, you said that the ordinance should be upheld if there's any set of facts that support the rational basis or that demonstrate a rational basis. So what level of proof is required to demonstrate a rational basis? The respondents argue that there isn't evidence that this ordinance will in effect result in increased placement of individuals with vouchers in rental housing if this ordinance were to take effect.
So to answer the immediate question, the standard is it has to be at least be debatable that there was enough evidence before the city for the city to believe that there was a rational connection between its plausible objective and its means chosen. But to clarify what the plaintiffs say is, at most, the city is going to increase housing opportunities for 250 families. That's 250 families made up of people of color, low income, disability, that even though the housing authority is handing out more vouchers than they can even fund, because they know these housing choice voucher recipients are being rejected right and left. There's still 250 with these being doled out like golden tickets that still can't get housing. So that's their argument, is that 250 isn't enough. And what we said in our reply is there's no threshold requirement that we have to impact enough people. All there has to be is a rational connection between the means chosen and the objective to be achieved. And here, the state purpose is that the amendment will increase housing opportunities for voucher holders. The district court never conducted a rational basis review of that stated purpose. And that is absolutely against well-established law that the district court can't set aside the stated purposes. So if you go through that rational connection, the city council had before it information from a congressman's representative, people from public housing authorities, voucher holders themselves, the people from the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority saying, our voucher holders are going out, they're asking landlords, will you accept a voucher? And they're saying no. And there was a survey by Homeline that says that of all of the properties that should have been affordable to voucher holders with their voucher, only 23% were accepting vouchers. Now, if you look at, so then if you connect that information with the means of the ordinance, it says, even if you put aside the potential for prejudice or motivations, if as the owners say, they won't accept voucher holders because they object to the program, that means that anytime a voucher holder applies to them, they're being rejected. What the ordinance says is, you can't say you don't like the lease that's required by the MPHA or the terms of that, or that reinspections are required. And so at a minimum, although they're subject to lawful screening criteria and housing occupancy standards, when that voucher holder's application comes through, they have to at least do the individual basis. It cannot possibly be conceived that making landlords apply their lawful screening criteria to housing choice voucher holders doesn't somehow increase the propensity that they might find housing.
I want, Council, if I could, I'd like to, you made the point in terms of the general purpose of increasing housing opportunities for HCV holders. What about but the district court didn't address that issue. The district court did address the issue of the stated goal of preventing and prohibiting discriminatory practices. Why do you think that was wrong under the rational basis analysis?
The first reason why it's wrong is because he assumed that the word discrimination means that we were calling the landlords racists or having animus or disliking poor people. And the plain language definition of discrimination, which is in the text of the ordinance, focuses on the fact that discrimination is a practice or a policy that adversely affects protected class members underneath the ordinance, including causing segregation. There's no requirement of a finding that the landlords acted with animus. So when the district court repeatedly says that we're accusing all landlords of being racist or having acted with prejudice, that totally disregards the textual definition of discrimination. It is undisputed in the record, the city council received a Homeline study, which is doc number 40, exhibit 9, that showed that when they surveyed the landlords about who would be willing to accept housing choice voucher holders, there was an intense congregation in Ward 4 and 5 of Minneapolis, but these are all the ones that the voucher holders could have had it. In every single ward, there were apartments that the voucher holders should have been able to rent to, but instead, the only ones that were the landlords that were willing to accept were in 4 and 5s. Those are racially concentrated areas of poverty. It is undisputed that if you adopt the ordinance at a minimum, it means they get to apply here. They get to apply in Ward 3 and 7, 10, 9, 8, 2, 13, 11, 12. They can't do that now because the voucher holders say we don't like the program requirements. Not because we dislike poor people or because we don't want to rent to the 78% that are people of color. We don't like the program requirements. But this opens up. And so you can't possibly conclude that there's not a rational connection between requiring landlords to do individual assessments here and the possibility that they could get more housing.
I'm sorry, finish up.
Well, so the court said this is only true if it's because of racism or dislike or animus. And the textual definition does not require a finding of animus on behalf of the landlords.
Well, if in fact there's a violation of the ordinance, I mean, what are the remedies of the tenant?
So the tenant would come forward to the Minneapolis Civil Rights Department, and they would make a complaint. And after that complaint was made, the landlords would have 20 days they could request an extension, but generally 20 days in order to submit their response. For example, they could submit a response saying, we didn't reject the tenant merely because they're housing choice voucher holder. Instead, I have a triplex and my mother-in-law decided to move into town, and so we took it off the market. Or I'm deciding to sell this unit, and so I'm not renting to anyone else. Or I looked at their application and they didn't meet the lawful screening criteria. And after that point, after they have had an opportunity to submit their rebuttal or to say, it's true, we didn't want to engage in the process, the program, because it's too burdensome. Here are all the reasons why it would be unduly burdensome for me. For example, I own a triplex, and I need the rent on the third unit in order to meet my mortgage.
All right. Are they limited to the defense of undue burden? I mean, it's an undue hardship?
They can reject based upon occupancy standards, anything permitted by Minnesota state law. They can reject based upon lawful screening criteria. They can reject based upon undue hardship. And they can reject based upon all these other kind of factual considerations, which is just the unit wasn't really actually for rent. We were not motivated by the requirements of the program.
All right.
After that, there's a mediation. There's another conciliation. And then the Civil Rights Department comes up with a determination that can be appealed to the Commission on the Department of Civil Rights.
I guess my next question is, though, did the tenants have the full remedy that they would have for any kind of discrimination charge that they may want to pursue?
Certainly against the
landlord in this venue.
I hope I'm answering the question. So any other violation that they found to exist that is otherwise included underneath the Department of Civil Rights, they could concurrently make that complaint. But for the purposes of this amendment, they would need to prove that the reason why they were rejected was because the landlord objected to the requirements of the Housing Choice Voucher Program.
And if that's shown, what are the remedies then?
The remedies are, I mean, this is a long process. The Department of Civil Rights has approximately 270-day process because they gather so much information in this conciliation. So for a practical matter, for that individual tenant, they are still having to go out and find another house to find.
But the landlord's sitting there with an empty...
No. The landlord can rent during that process. There's nothing in the ordinance that says that once a complaint is made, you have to open it, keep it held open indefinitely. That's absolutely not a requirement. What would in theory happen, though, is the landlord would recognize from the ruling on that decision that their arguments about why they have an undue hardship have either been accepted or not accepted, and they should comport with the requirements of the ordinance at that point.
Well, and I think one of the points made by the respondents is that, you know, in an ordinary discrimination charge, you would do the McDonnell Douglas analysis. But here you almost start out with, yes, there's discrimination.
That's because this is a substantive rule of law.
Okay.
This is a substantive rule of law. This is the city council saying, we are concerned about low-income individuals, almost all of which are protected class members, being unable to find housing, period, meaning either a temporary homelessness or that they're being forced into racially concentrated areas of poverty. So we have decided that policy prerogative trumps the objections of the landlords to the Housing Choice Voucher Program. So that's not a finding of animus. That's a finding that landlords' policies of universally rejecting housing choice voucher holders has deleterious effects.
I know you're saying it doesn't require animus, that you don't have to prove that they did it because they, you know, for some illegal reason, rather than just that it's increasing their costs and they can't afford to do it, you know, that won't cut it. But you're coming into this proceeding with the assumption that they've already discriminated. And that's I think, what the objection is, as I understand it.
Okay, I appreciate that.
So that you may not need animus, you may not need to prove animus, but they're a little different than most situations where at least there has to be some showing by the other side of a discrimination. Here, it's just assumed. This is discriminatory.
So
I think that's what is being argued here.
Well, but the housing choice voucher holder, when they come to the Department of Civil Rights, has to prove that they were rejected because the landlord objected to the housing choice voucher program requirements. That's their burden of proof. So if there's these other reasons, the screening criteria, the mother-in-law.
But do you see what is happening, though, or what they're claiming is happening, is that it doesn't matter whether they were discriminating or not. That determination's already made just by virtue of the fact that they don't want to engage in this program.
I think that question still belies a belief that discrimination means animus. All discrimination means is we've got a pattern going on. Well, we know what's happening. This is happening, whether or not it was ill-intended or not.
All right, thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
As you can tell, this is a very interesting case, and we have a number of questions for both sides. So.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Tamara O'Neill Moreland. I'm an attorney for the respondents. I'm here with my co-counsel, Inga Shugart. And one of the things that I think is primary in this case, and based on your questions, I do think that you understand it. This ordinance is a civil rights ordinance. We're not talking about housing regulations. We're not talking about zoning.
Why not? It is talking
rules.
About housing regulations. That's one of the first criteria, is talking about how public purpose is increasing housing opportunities for HCB vouchers. That's the primary one, and even the district court acknowledged that.
But they didn't put it in a housing ordinance.
Why does that matter? A statute can have multiple purposes, and you have to put it somewhere, or an ordinance can have multiple purposes, and you have to put it somewhere in the code. So is simply because it's in the civil rights section, does that mean it has no other purpose?
It doesn't mean it has no other purpose. What it means is that once you put it in the civil rights ordinance, you are making a determination, or the city has this conclusive, irrebuttable presumption that if you do not participate in a program, you have committed discrimination.
But
and
that,
that's why
that doesn't go to the purpose. That goes to what the language of the statute is. I mean, you're right that the statute defines discrimination in that manner, but that doesn't speak to the purpose. That speaks to the language of the statute.
Correct. They have articulated, I believe, three purposes. One is to stop discrimination. That was the first one. The court focused on that in the district court because that was their main purpose. Their other ones that they're now articulating are to allow HVC holders to find more housing and for the property owners in Minneapolis to help the city stop the segregation it created with all of their recap areas. And regardless of the purpose of the ordinance, the fact that it is a civil rights ordinance is extremely important because it's not imposing a regulation. It's not saying that if on this block we're going to give out 10 licenses for housing, or if you are a landlord, you need to make sure that you follow these laws. What it's saying is that if you're a landlord and there is a voluntary federal program out there that you have chosen not to participate in, because it's onerous and you can't afford to do so, it doesn't matter.
Well, it does, because it does provide for exceptions. I mean, you're making it sound like it's a blanket. You shall participate in this no matter what, and that's not the case here.
Well, but it doesn't, because the only defense stated in that entire ordinance is undue hardship.
Right.
There is never a determination during that process that the landlord didn't discriminate. They take intent out of discrimination. Under Minnesota law, intent is vital for discrimination.
But isn't that really a preemption argument? Aren't you? I mean, what we're looking at here is due process and equal protection.
As part of due process, there is an entire line of cases that have conclusive irrebuttable presumptions. And what those cases have said is that when there is a conclusive presumption, and it doesn't matter if they want to call it a substantive rule of law, when there is a conclusive presumption of nefarious intent, it violates the due process clause. The case Weinsman is the one that the district court looked at very carefully. And that actually was an economic regulation case, which is held to a different standard than when you are determining that people are committing discrimination. But what that case determined was that you can't, if the result of your presumptive conclusion is a nefarious intent, which is different than you're just making an economic regulation, then it's not going to fly. What they said was, and I think this quote is extremely telling when you look at it in light of our case, and this is about profitless sales of cigarettes, if all profitless sales were always or even usually made for the purpose of injuring, so that it could be said that such sales in and of themselves were sinister, then the legislation was within its rights in creating a presumption. But there is no evidence in the record to justify that such sales have been as the result of an intent to do evil.
But why, I'm confused as to why it results in a presumption of discrimination, because that certainly could be part of the underlying, but it's not a blanket. I mean, it could be any number of things. It could be based on economics, which I think, quite frankly, is an overriding factor probably in many of these situations. It could be a logistical issue. So you can have several different purposes that it's trying to resolve, one of which is preventing discrimination, but that's not necessarily the overriding one.
But that's the overriding one that's actually stated in the ordinance. The ordinance says that it is discrimination in property rights to use any requirement of a public assistance program as a motivating factor not to rent. So anytime a landlord says,
a motivating factor, not the motivating factor.
Well, even if it's a motivating factor, but people don't participate in this program because of the requirements of them. They're very onerous requirements. And the exact language of their civil rights ordinance says that it is discrimination if you're not renting because you don't like the program or you don't want to participate in the program. So this idea that
it may be discrimination because of the result, but that doesn't mean that it necessarily implies that their intent is there to discriminate.
Under their ordinance, intents are relevant. Because if you didn't participate in the program, the complainant has a standing.
Right,
it doesn't matter. They never talk about it.
Right, but that's something that the district court seemed to get hung up on, though.
The district court got hung up on the fact that they never, ever look at whether you actually discriminated.
Right, the intent element of it.
Right, and because there is. If you're going to rule, if you're at the end of the day going to find that a landlord has violated somebody's civil rights under a discrimination law, then intent is extraordinarily important.
Right, but still, even here, I mean, even if you have that presumption, it still has to be proved. I mean, just because a tenant comes in and says, hey, I think they violated my rights, it's not like they can come in and they get a check written to them, or all of a sudden they're in that housing the next day. It's still something that is subject to the normal due process, that the landlord can say, no, here's why that doesn't apply, and here's why I did not engage. Here's why I refused.
But it doesn't go through that process. All they have to show under the ordinance is that the landlord didn't agree to participate in
right,
the program.
But the landlord
That's
has
all.
The opportunity to answer that. It's not
yeah,
like-
but
isn't this case distinguishable from Weissman, though, because of the statute at issue there? And it explicitly had language that retailers that sell below cost have done so with the intent or effect of injuring a competitor. Whereas here, the ordinance just defines what discrimination does. It doesn't talk about intent or animus.
But discrimination under Minnesota law requires intent and animus. So simply saying that in the city of Minneapolis, I'm sorry,
finish your thought.
In the city of Minneapolis, we're going to find people have committed discrimination, but by the way, that doesn't really mean what the state law means.
But again, I guess I understand that argument, and you may have a very good preemption argument, but to me that's more of a preemption argument than it is a due process argument.
I think that the reason Weissman applies is this idea of fact-proven does not, if the fact-proven has to support the fact-presumed. And that's what the cases, appellants cite many, many cases from other jurisdictions. And all of them talk about fact-proven supporting fact-presumed.
But here the fact-proven is that the fact-proven would be that the landlord didn't accept the voucher.
Right, and the fact presumed is that was discrimination, and I don't
under
think
the and that is by definition under the Minneapolis ordinance discrimination, because discrimination doesn't require animus under the Minneapolis ordinance. It just requires I'll have to pull up the exact definition, but it's any act which results in unequal treatment, separation, or segregation of, or which otherwise adversely affects any person who's a member of a class or combination of classes protected by this title. So by definition, if the landlord didn't accept the voucher, that would constitute discrimination under the ordinance.
That is exactly what the ordinance says. But under the city is still subject to Minnesota law. They're still subject to our Constitution, and they're still subject to
right.
our
that
case
goes
law.
I think that goes to the point that Judge Cochran is talking about, though. That's the
preemption.
Thank you. Doesn't that argument go to the preemption?
Well, it absolutely issue? Also goes to preemption.
But that's not something that we're talking about, the substantive due process right. as well as the equal protection here,
but
preemption.
But it also goes to due process because the appellant's argument is that they can have a conclusive presumption. And our reply to that was, no, you can't. And it also goes to the fact that the
what
court
about
of appeals,
their argument that this is a substantive law? It's not a presumption.
Well, a substantive law has to abide by the Constitution. And a substantive law that has a conclusive presumption is exactly that. They're not different. And I do want to point out two cases that this court has already determined where it has said that the failure to participate in the Section 8 program does not create a conclusive presumption of unlawful discrimination. It specifically determined that such a determination would disregard the importance of the landlord's intent under the law. A landlord might not choose to participate in the Section 8 program for non-discriminatory reasons, such as the unwillingness to bear the cost of satisfying the administrative requirements. This court has looked at this issue twice.
Not in this exact context, though.
Not in this exact context. There has not been a city that has taken the Minnesota Human Rights Act and decided, well, we're not only going to protect people, we're going to protect a program and call it discrimination if you don't participate in the program. That is the first time that this has happened. That is true.
Could I ask you, because I mean, it seems like one figure, and I don't see a lot of dispute about this figure, is that 23%, only 23% of the available units for these vouchers accepts the vouchers, and that the city, having an issue with this and having many complaints, spent a lot of time trying to figure out a way to increase this participation. And in trying to get to the other 77% of the landlords out there pass this ordinance, which basically, and I'm going to paraphrase a little bit, but you tell me where it's wrong, that in order to accomplish this goal, that everyone agrees there's not enough affordable housing, we're going to pass this ordinance and we're going to solve this problem, because we're going to just make it basically an expense of doing business in our city that every landlord has to accept this. If we apply the rational basis test to that, I mean, can we say that this was an arbitrary and capricious way of dealing with this issue that the city council had before it?
We can, because this ordinance will never solve the affordable housing crisis in Minneapolis. This is a very tiny program.
Well,
this
does it have to solve the crisis completely? Or, I mean, as long as there are facts that reasonably support the stated goal, isn't that enough? I mean, otherwise, a rational basis test would, if you're requiring 100% eradication of an issue, it would never fly.
But this is such a small portion of the issue.
So who cares if it's a small portion? If you're still helping 253 families, who cares if it's two or three families? If it's still helping, maybe a better question is, what number would be the floor for you then?
Well, I don't think there is a number, because nobody's ever actually said, despite depositions and direct questions, where we asked how many people actually can't find housing under this. And nobody's been able to tell us what that number is. But the problem is, and the real way that they could have fixed this, is the payment standards. They
But they didn't. That's not before us. What's before us is an ordinance that they put in place that they thought, after 2 years of hearing testimony, would at least make a difference in terms of providing housing for people.
But it can't make a difference because of the payment standards, because only 25% of all units, regardless of participation, fall under the payment standards. And those units all lie within recap.
Right, but that's a decision that's already been, that information was before the city council. They've already made that decision. It's not up for us as an error correcting court to weigh the pros and cons and benefits. All we have to do is look at to determine under what's an appropriate standard and whether or not that appropriate standard is being met.
But when looking at a legitimate public purpose, the courts look at whether the law will achieve the purpose. And if all of the properties that can fall in this group of voucher holders are in certain areas and subject to payment caps, and at best they're going to be able to move from one recap to another recap, it does not have a legitimate public purpose. We are not.
But basically what you're arguing is you don't think this is going to work at all, then, right?
No, we don't think it's going to work at all.
Okay, but that's your position. But as long as there's a potential for it to work, that's all that really matters to support a rational basis analysis, right?
Well, I think they have to prove that there's a potential for it to work. I don't think you get to just say this is going to work and not be able to support it.
The legislature passes laws all the time that they don't know are going to work for sure. They hope they'll work, they think they'll work, but they don't know for sure. And they don't always, you know, I think it's unlikely that every law has facts that prove that the law will in fact work. So it seems to me the standard that you're suggesting is higher than what the rational basis test requires.
I That's not what I'm intending to say. I'm intending to say that you can't just make a statement that's not supported. And I understand that not all, you know, laws that are passed, we absolutely know they're going to work. But not all laws that are passed take away people's due process rights. Not all laws that are passed tell people who have no nefarious intent that you have discriminated because you can't afford to be in this program. You don't want to be in a contract for the federal government. You don't want to lose money because your units have to be open for these onerous inspections. Not all laws that are trying to achieve something do it on the backs of a select number of private property owners. When a city wants to solve a public harm, they are required to spread the cost of that harm over all of their taxpayers. They are not allowed to pick and choose ones.
Going back just, we may have a couple more questions for you. You're over your time, but we allowed appellant to go over because of our questions. And going back to your argument that this creates a conclusive irrebuttable presumption of a discriminatory intent. If instead the Minneapolis City Council had passed an ordinance that said all landlords shall accept Section 8 vouchers and put it in the housing section, would that address your concern in that regard? I know there's other concerns. I know your clients have concerns about the cost of compliance with this program and the administrative burden and a number of other concerns. But in terms of that concern, would that have addressed your concern?
I think that as a presumptive conclusion, maybe, but there's a whole other set of concerns. There's a reason why this didn't go through that process. And it's not before the court, but to directly answer your question, I don't think the Minneapolis Charter allows them to do that. They had to go through this weird version of calling people discriminating because they couldn't put it in their housing code. But we've never briefed it, we've never deposed anybody on it, so I can't tell you for sure.
Issue's not before us. Okay.
Right.
All right, any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks.
You're taller than me. Okay, I didn't realize that. This amendment is in the Civil Rights Department because if we put it in the housing regulations, our city's inspectors and the Regulatory Services Department would be analyzing undue hardship. But because it's in the Civil Rights Department, our civil rights investigators, which at the time of this amendment were all lawyers, have years of experience going through the 270-day process of evaluating claims. Every time you heard the respondent talk about irrebuttable conclusive presumptions or substantive law, that only applies if you're looking at the third stated purpose identified by the city. You don't need to look at the conclusions or a substantive rule of law if you're looking at either of the first two purposes, which contrary to the plaintiff's
assertion. And why is that?
Because the reason why they're claiming there's the conclusive presumption is inaccurate is because they're saying that the ordinance accuses them of ill intent. They say discrimination in law in Minnesota requires intent. And so that's only true under the third purpose, which takes on the more common sense definition of discrimination.
But under this plan, is the McDonnell Douglas analysis out the window and it's replaced with this, what you've got one defense here and your defense is undue hardship?
Again, that is not the only defense. So,
well, I know, but there's other. But the only meaningful defense that the landlord can bring. I mean, obviously, if they don't qualify for other reasons, they could raise that, but.
The sole intent at issue is that the voucher holder holds the burden of showing that they were rejected because the landlord objected to the housing choice voucher program requirements. That's the intent. the voucher holder holds that burden, and they can rebut it during the 270-day process.
Okay, but their only way to rebut it, though, as I understand it, is this undue hardship. Am I correct?
No. No, so
there may be other things about they're not qualified or something like that, but...
Well, those are all reasons why the ordinance hasn't been violated. So if the landlord is able to show, I just took it off the market, they didn't meet lawful screening criteria, they didn't meet lawful occupancy standards, or this would be an undue hardship, then they've proven that the program requirements weren't the motivating factor. See,
but if the owner says, the reason I didn't rent is because this program is burdensome, not because I have any particular animus against this individual who wants to rent, that wouldn't be a sufficient reason for not renting.
Absent an undue hardship, I think we'd question why 1,200 other property owners are able to take on this requirement, but property owners that have professional management companies with presidents making six figures can't understand how to work this program despite a year's worth of improvements made by the MPHA. I think we would question that. And the Civil Rights Department would go through the criteria used to determine whether or not there's undue hardship. But,
you know, can I go, because this really bothers me too, is that we're being asked to analyze this. And I assume that we give deference to the City Council in terms of, I mean, it's a very narrow standard, right? As to whether they, you know, is arbitrary and capricious, but we also have to determine whether it's constitutional. The ordinance itself is facially constitutional. But in doing that analysis, I think underlying this, I mean, I read the two briefs, and this analogy of the blind people describing the elephant and coming up with two different scenarios. Because if I listen to you, I mean, I think there is clearly a huge issue with affordable housing. And I don't even think the respondents are disputing that. But what they're saying is that by doing this, the city's actually going to make it worse because, number one, the landlords are probably going to start jacking up the rents to cover all these additional expenses. That's going to make the housing even less affordable. They may choose, you know, a lot of landlords may hear about this and decide not to build in Minneapolis because it's just too many regulations. I mean, you know, is this something that we should consider in trying to analyze these issues? I mean, because, and I understand what you're saying, you've got 77% of the landlords, for whatever reason, and it doesn't matter, won't even participate in this program. So I can see the tension here, but how is the court to resolve this tension in deciding whether there's a rational basis for this? If we decide the rational basis that this is, if we adopt what they're saying, then I mean, the respondent's position, does that mean that it's not rational? How do we analyze this?
The answer to that is you don't consider those arguments. Those are arguments that were made to the City Council, and there was counter evidence that was at least reasonably debatable that the City Council could rely upon. Specifically, this notion that the rents are going to increase. Kyle Hansen, who's the director of the HGV program, said, we have the ability to alter the payment standards and we can get more funding for HUD. So if landlords increase rent, we can counter that. Additionally, there was testimony from the owners saying, we can't just randomly increase our rent because we need to charge all of our tenants the same amount. And we can only charge what our neighboring property is. But more fundamentally, the question is there a logical connection between making landlords make an individual assessment of Housing Choice Vouchers applicants rather than making blanket objections to them because they don't like the program, and the ability of Housing Choice Voucher holders to increase their housing options? Obviously, if the application goes in the garbage every time, they don't have a chance. But the ordinance says You need to look at it. You need to say, do they meet the screening criteria? Can they pay otherwise? Do they have felony? Whatever the standards is. And if it is, and that's the one you're looking at, you have to give them a home, absent undue hardship or some lawful screening criteria. I don't know how the difference between garbage or individual assessment isn't a clear logical connection between the stated purpose, which this court is legally required to consider, is the stated purpose of increasing housing opportunities. And it's important to remember, this isn't some after the fact, we're making it up because we were really calling them racist, but now we're just trying to increase housing options. This was in the request for committee action that the goal was to increase housing opportunities. This was in the hours-long hearing where Council President Johnson said, I think this amendment will increase opportunities for people, quite frankly, to move out of my North Minneapolis ward, where there's a huge concentration of voucher holders, and move to other areas of the city.
Well, I just want to follow up then. How do we determine which facts we should consider? I mean, like, I think there, a fact that we can consider here is there's a great need. We can consider that only according, and I didn't see any dispute on the 23% of the available housing is participating. The rest are not. How do we sort these facts out? Because it certainly seems to be a very different story here. And is this an appropriate action for summary judgment?
I would say yes, it is appropriate for summary judgment because we've submitted a record to the court. What you see here is two sides of a policy debate. They're saying it's not going to work. Some landlords were counteracted by increasing rent. But the city council considered that. It also considered the testimony of the district representative for Congressman Ellisman, Homeline, Legal Aid, the director for Downtown Congregation and Homelessness, a whole slew of AON, a whole bunch of public assistance organizations, and the Minneapolis Public Housing Authority that said, this increases the opportunity for housing choice voucher holders to get housing. And so the sole question to you is the evidence before them at least reasonably debatable that the city council could have conceived that the information before it connected the purpose of increasing housing option to the end objective, which was if we require individual assessment of applications, housing choice voucher holders might get housing. That's the only connection you need to make on purpose one. And you don't have to go to the third step of, is there prejudice? Is it irrebuttable presumption? Is it a substantive rule of law? You can stay in the first purpose. We don't have to win on every purpose.
So, in your view, how is the Weissman case distinguishable or not applicable?
Well,
I read your reply brief, yeah. And I know you address it there, but if you could explain it in a little more detail.
Well, it depends on which purpose you're under. Candidly, if you're underneath a third purpose, then it's debatable whether or not, then we would tell you that you should be going to the usury case, which says that even if the city uses an improper misnomer of calling it prejudice, and people believe that means animus, if the city council still fundamentally has the police powers to enact this legislation, to help people get housing options, then it's proper. If it's underneath the first purpose, then you're not even assessing that because this is you're not even assessing whether or not there's an irrebuttable presumption because clearly, as you read, Your Honor, the definition of discrimination underneath the text of the ordinance doesn't imply animus. And so there's no presumption that any of the landlords have acted with animus. What the ordinance says is, it is discriminatory to cause segregation, adverse effects, or unequal treatment, and we decide that there is segregation, adverse effects, or unequal treatment if landlords use the housing choice voucher program requirements as a motivating factor in rejecting applicants. And that's borne out by the 23% statistic. That's borne out by the map that shows that there's only basically three or four wards that are accepting where landlords accept housing choice voucher holders, when in reality every ward has actual units available.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, the matter was very well briefed and very well argued by both parties. We will take the matter, and we will, the matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the 90-day statutory time period. Yes.